Our third case for the day, 08-AP-1521-CR, State v. Amani. Arguing on behalf of the State of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General Thomas Balestrieri. Mr. Balestrieri.
Thank you, Your Honor. The basic question in this case, which really isn't a question at all, given the plethora of authority that exists on this issue, is what is the appropriate remedy when a court fails to hold the colloquy required by this court in State versus Klesic? Now, yesterday I sent the court a copy of a recent, very recent opinion by the Court of Appeals, District 2, which I consider to be a mea culpa, an admission that they were wrong in this case in remanding it for a new trial instead of a retrospective evidentiary hearing. That case is State versus Tom Garcia.
So have you given a copy of this to Mr. Loeb?
Yes.
Okay, fine.
And this was
different district, same district.
Second district. Two of the three judges who were on the panel in Amani were on the panel in Garcia.
Mr. Balestrieri, before district. You get too far into this, I would like to talk to you about the one issue. I certainly noticed that the state conceded that, or appears to concede that there's one issue about the remedy, the retrospective hearing versus the new trial. But in this instance, where Judge Davis did not allow the defendant to go unrepresented, why would the judge in that particular instance have to go through the entire Klesic colloquy if one part of Klesic isn't met? Then it seems to me, because the defendant has to meet all of the requirements before a knowing, voluntary, intelligent decision to go forward pro se can be made. If the court finds that one of them isn't met, why does the court then have to continue through the whole colloquy?
Well, if there was a situation where the court made a clear finding after holding at least part of the colloquy required by Klesic that the defendant had not established one of the elements in Klesic, I think you would be right, that the judge would not have to continue with the rest of the colloquy.
So what was it about Judge Davis's observations about the flippant, short-term, these are quotes from the transcript, quote, flippant, short-term, immature, end quote, and the observations about concern of lack of competency to represent himself that seemed to be unclear. What more would have had to have been required?
Well, I think what more was required is that the judge should have actually asked the defendant about what was apparent from his attitude, and that is, it was apparent from his attitude that he was only making his request to proceed pro se because he was angry about losing the suppression motion.
And the fingerprint issue.
Well, the fingerprint issue hadn't come up yet.
Right.
He was also angry because his attorney had not yet made a motion to do something with the fingerprint evidence. I'm not sure exactly
how many, how many lawyers prior to the one who argued the suppression portion of the motion had Mr. Amani discharged?
I counted four.
Okay.
Although some of them may not have been expressly discharged by Amani, but they were nevertheless on the case and then removed from the case. I count two instances in which Amani actually specifically asked on the record to discharge the attorneys, but there were four who represented him at various times.
Well, I noted, for instance, the Court of Appeals seemed to place a great amount of weight on Judge Davis's efforts to keep the trial calendar intact and to keep the case
moving. And that was a little bit of a problem, yeah.
Well, Is there anything in the record to indicate that Mr. Amani's prior discharge of other attorneys may have put Judge Davis on a heightened awareness of a particularized need in this instance?
No, there's nothing. Unfortunately, there's nothing in the record, and that's, you know, the problem with not having a full Klessig hearing. There's nothing on the record which suggests why it was so important to go ahead with the trial on the trial date that was set, other than that the judge just wanted to keep his calendar. Okay, getting back to Garcia.
Let me just clarify this. The issue before us is only the remedy?
That's correct.
You're not saying that the trial court the Court of Appeal erred in saying the colloquy was insufficient?
No, we're not saying that.
Just the remedy?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
That's true with the defense, too. Just remedy. That's
well, no, that's, I don't think that is true of the defendant.
Why?
Because the defendant argued in the Court of Appeals and has resurrected that argument in this court that there was actually an adequate colloquy, a colloquy that was adequate to show that there was a knowing and intelligent waiver of counsel.
So what do they want? I'll ask them. Go ahead.
I think they want a new trial.
You wind up the same.
The remedy that is the issue.
The issue is the trial. It's the
right.
Remedy. Okay.
Okay.
How about harmless error? Does harmless error apply?
I'm sorry?
How about harmless error? Does harmless error apply here?
Not to the failure to hold the colloquy, no.
Who says?
Well, I think Klessig pretty much says that.
But
unless you want to say differently.
No, I'm just asking you. You say you think Klessig says that can't apply harmless error for an inadequate colloquy.
I think Klessig establishes an absolute rule.
Okay, thank you.
As in almost all of these other cases that also involve a colloquy.
What you have is...
That's concerning the instance where the judge allows the individual to proceed pro se.
Right.
I don't think there's a difference in terms of whether the judge allows or doesn't allow the individual to proceed pro se.
I think it's the same kind of violation of a constitutional right to deny someone counsel as it is to... not ascertain whether the person could proceed on his own?
Well, I think you have, there's two different issues here, and I want to make this absolutely clear. In this case, there is no evidence of a violation of Imani's right to counsel.
Right.
The issue in this case is strictly procedural, that there wasn't an adequate hearing to determine whether there was a Sixth Amendment violation. If there have been a Sixth Amendment violation, new trial, no question about it. But that's not the violation. The violation is simply a procedural one, a failure to hold an adequate hearing.
Because he's got two rights. One, a right to proceed pro se, and another, a right to counsel and their intention. So you hold the colloquy to see which one is going to prevail.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that's the basis. Klessig, and the basis of the constitutional issues that we're having.
Right. You avoid the constitutional problem by having the colloquy.
Okay. Remedy. How can the circuit, how come the, was the opinion, and I'm busily looking at it, the opinion in Amani published?
Yes, it is a published opinion.
So why aren't they bound by Amani and Garcia?
Because Amani is wrong.
Here nor there. They don't. Where do they get the authority to reverse themselves? Because once it's published, it's precedent, and it's as good precedent. If it's done by the Court of Appeals or it's done by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So where do they get the authority?
Well, you know, there are some exceptions to that rule under Cook. And one of the exceptions would be where the ruling of the Court of Appeals is contrary to a ruling of this court. And that's the situation we have here.
Mr. Ballester,
Imani is contrary to Klessig.
Just to answer, I think, what the Chief was asking, in the case you gave us, Garcia, it deals with the right to testify. And so it's a Weed case rather than the case we have here with Plessick. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
So in a sense, it's a little different issue than what
it is a different issue, but the paragraph of the opinion that I want to point you to is actually paragraph 9. And in paragraph 9, the Court of Appeals acknowledges that the proper remedy for the failure to hold a Plessick hearing is to hold a retrospective hearing. That's why I brought this Garcia case to your attention.
So it's dicta.
Sorry?
It's dicta, because it doesn't cover this case.
Whether it's dicta or not is not important to me. What's important to me
is
that they're acknowledging one way or the other in dicta or in binding precedent.
Right.
They're acknowledging that Plessick says the remedy is a retrospective hearing.
Right.
Our position, of course, always has been that they might have dicta in their opinions. We never have dicta in ours.
Most of the time.
I think the Court of Appeals thinks that they never have dicta either.
Until they don't, you know.
Until they don't want to acknowledge it, right.
Okay. What specific words? I have paragraph 9 in front of me, and I'm trying to listen and read at the same time. What words are you focusing on in paragraph 9? And I know there's a distinction between the case that we have here in Plessick, where Plessick actually, if I recall correctly, what is it? That in Plessick, he went through with a trial without counsel.
Right.
Plessick
was allowed to proceed pro se.
Without counsel, yes.
And then on appeal, he claimed he shouldn't have been allowed to proceed pro se. Yeah. The judge should have denied his request, and he should have had counsel.
Does that procedural posture, if you will, and one of the arguments is that procedural posture allows for a different remedy here. Does that argument tie in, or is it addressed in paragraph 9?
No, it's not. It's not. The language in paragraph 9, if I can just kind of pick and choose, what it says is the remedy that has been crafted to address the court's failure to engage in a colloquy with the defendant when the defendant waives the right to counsel, blah, 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 blah. When the circuit court neglects to hold the appropriate colloquy, the state carries the burden to prove that at a hearing. They don't really say the hearing, but they carry the burden at a retrospective hearing to show that the waiver was knowing and intelligent. So you have to, you know, just kind of pick and choose words out of that paragraph. But what they're basically saying is, yeah, we acknowledge that in Plessick, the court said that the appropriate remedy was a retrospective hearing for failure to hold a colloquy on a defendant's waiver of counsel.
Why is this case not different from Plessick? This is not different, and I can't find the part in Plessick that says what you're telling me it says, essentially that it's structural error as the denial of the right to counsel. Okay, then why doesn't harmless error apply? Because we apply harmless error to many potential constitutional violations.
This isn't a constitutional violation.
I understand that, but you didn't analyze in your brief. It's all the more reason why you should have analyzed, I think, harmless error under this case. I mean, why isn't it harmless error?
Because as I understand the rule in Plessick, it's an absolute rule. You don't hold a colloquy, then you need to hold a retrospective.
Plessick is based on the fact the man ended up with really no counsel because he wasn't competent to do it himself. So in essence, it was a denial of the right to counsel because the court did not ascertain carefully about whether he was able to do this on his own. That's not where we are here. That's not where we are here at all.
Well, where we are here is an alleged violation of his right to proceed pro se, which is also a Sixth Amendment violation.
It may be, but there are many constitutional violations, and we still apply harmless error to them. There are very few that we
don't. I reiterate, this is not a constitutional violation.
All right. Well, let's just talk a potential constitutional violation, okay? But I don't understand why you don't analyze it for harmless error, whatever you want to label it.
Well, the reason is because as I read Klessig, and I could be wrong in my reading of Klessig, but as I read Klessig, Klessig says you either hold the colloquy, and if you don't hold the colloquy, then the then you have to hold a retrospective colloquy.
Well,
that's the way I read.
I'm not finding it. I just read it again. So if you know the page when you sit down, you can let me know, or the paragraph.
Well, Klessig went without counsel, so you can, and there wasn't a finding that he was competent to do that, or a colloquy that was competent to do that. You can argue you don't have counsel, you're at a great disadvantage, even if you're pretty good yourself, right?
Right.
I think this is the point of the harmless error discussion we're having. Imani had counsel, right?
He did.
All right. So, if I'm right, supposition is, or presumption is, or inference is, whatever you want to label it, is that counsel is better than no counsel, then why is it harmless, why is it not harmless error when you have an attorney? And I think the answer is because if he's competent, he has a right to go without a counsel.
That's correct. It's a structural violation.
No, yes. Well, show me where it says it's structural violation. That's where you're losing me.
Okay, Klessig doesn't say that. There are other cases that say that it is a structural violation.
And what does a structural violation mean? It means that the structure of the trial itself has been impeded. You know, you didn't have
wrong.
Fair counsel, you didn't have a fair jury, right. That kind of structural violation. That's what it refers to.
Yeah, and the case that I cite at page 6 of my brief is State versus Harvey.
Yeah,
that says that improper denial of a defendant's right to conduct his own defense is a structural violation to which the harmless error rule doesn't apply. So if there is a constitutional violation in denying the defendant his right to proceed pro se, it's a structural violation. It's a violation in the very way the trial is conducted, and that's not subject to a harmless error analysis.
And that's a Wisconsin case.
Yes, right.
Denial of self-representation is a structural error.
But I understood your response to my earlier question to be that if more specific responses had been made by Mr. Imani or elicited by the trial court, then the full Klessig colloquy would not have been necessary. Does that remain your position?
That would remain my position. If there are four things that have to be established in the Klessig colloquy. In this case, the most important...
In order to go forward without representation. If one of those is not satisfied, then there will be trial counsel provided.
That's correct.
So therefore, if the trial court doesn't find that all four are met...
If the trial court were to find, and I'm referring to the facts of this case, the critical kind of thing in this case was, did Imani knowingly and intelligently ask to proceed pro se? That was really the critical thing here. If the trial court, after a full colloquy into, if the trial court had asked Imani, are you just waiving your right to counsel and asking to proceed pro se because you're mad at your attorney for the way he handled the suppression hearing, you know, we might have had a whole different ballgame here, but that question was never asked.
Is such an express question really necessary, especially when I don't know what the odds are that it would actually elicit an affirmative response if that was indeed the motive? Aren't trial court judges allowed to draw inferences from the entire circumstances and their observations that they can make in the trial court all the time?
Well, they can draw inferences. I think I have to agree with the Court of Appeals that given the colloquy in this case, given the exchange in this case, it was still pretty iffy. And in fact, I point to the fact that In this case, on this appeal, in this court, Imani is contending that the exchange that he had with the trial judge was sufficient to show that he knowingly and voluntarily waived his right to counsel. So at the very least, I think there's still a question about the knowing and voluntary nature of the waiver.
Well, what should the judge have said then? If Judge Davis, who obviously denied the motion, if he refers to Mr. Imani's motion as flippant, short-term, and immature, what else should he have said in order to...
It's not what he should have said, it's what he should have asked. He should have asked more questions of Imani to bolster that inference.
Well, what about the fact that he left the door open to Mr. Imani at some future time in between the date of the hearing and the date of the scheduled trial, 28 days later?
That would be an important factor at a retrospective hearing to show that, in fact, Imani really did want counsel. He did want an attorney representing him at a trial.
Well, even towards the end of the motion hearing, didn't Mr. Imani make a somewhat conditional statement about, well, I'll be ready for the trial in 28 days so long as I have my lawyer helping me investigate the fingerprints? So,
well, there was an equivocal statement, yeah. There was an equivocal statement about whether there was a real waiver, but it was equivocal.
Counsel, can you describe for me the circumstances that surrounded the four attorneys that Mr. Imani had?
No, actually, I can't. I've gathered that strictly from the CCAP version of the case, and it just indicates that in two instances, it doesn't indicate why the attorney was replaced. In two, it just says Imani asked to have counsel replaced, but there's nothing that I can point to that really tells us exactly why. I can tell you this. I can tell you that the two specific reasons that Imani gave for wanting his attorney replaced at the close of the suppression hearing were not really very good reasons. One of the reasons was that his attorney had not presented a videotape of a television news broadcast that apparently showed Imani's face. When the witness, and this was a motion to suppress an identification, when the witness whose identification was supposed to be suppressed said he hadn't seen that particular television broadcast, so it could not have possibly affected his identification, and Imani didn't seem to understand that, you know, that a television broadcast that the witness had never seen was really irrelevant. And then the other thing was this business about the fingerprint that was lifted from that suppression witness's automobile. Imani was upset that nothing had been done in a pretrial motion to kind of suppress that, although it's hard to imagine what could be done. I mean, it's no Fourth Amendment violation. It wasn't his car. And if there was a problem with the way the fingerprint identification was made, that was an issue for trial. So it's pretty obvious that Imani just didn't grasp what was going on in this
counsel,
case.
I have just been reading Harvey as I'm sitting here. And Harvey is a case that involves an erroneous jury instruction and whether or not that could be subjected to the harmless error analysis given the right to a correctly informed jury and the interaction of the Sixth Amendment. But there's nothing in Harvey about self-representation.
Well,
it's not what the case turns on.
What the case turned on, but there is a statement in there.
Okay, well, I won't take your time now, but when you sit down, if you could find it for me, I would appreciate it.
Well, actually, I cite it. I gave a specific pinpoint cite.
Paragraph 37. Paragraph 37 says, the court acknowledges that certain fundamental constitutional errors are not amenable to harmless error analysis, so extrinsically harmful as to require automatic reversal, i.e. affect substantial rights without regard to their effect on the outcome. But this compromised a limited class of errors. All other constitutional errors, including an erroneous jury instruction completely omitting an element of the offense, are subject to harmless error. So I put it to you that Harvey doesn't stand for that proposition.
Mr. Ballesteri, I'm a little at a loss as to how you can say here today, it's, quote, it's pretty obvious that Imani just didn't understand what was going on in this case, end quote. But at the same time, you seem to be taking the position that Judge Davis was under some compulsion to continue asking questions before coming to the conclusion that at that time, Mr. Imani wasn't prepared to represent himself.
Well, yeah, first of all, there. This case does not involve the total absence of any colloquy. There was some discussion, obviously. It's just that Judge Davis never really asked Imani the right questions, that Judge Davis drew some inferences from what Imani said, but he never actually pinpointed the questions that Klesig says he should have asked.
Justice Siegler, did you want to finish your comments?
The only sort of inference, if any, that I was wondering if you drew was, you know, you have a case that takes about a year, and you go through four lawyers. Four lawyers is a lot. In any case, you know, and it doesn't seem like he ever was without a lawyer. I mean, it seems like he always wanted a lawyer because, at least when I'm looking through what I have before me, it doesn't, you know, he obviously found people unsatisfactory and proceeded through a number of attorneys, but yet always ends up going back to the same
way. That is certainly a valid inference that can be drawn at a retrospective hearing on whether he knowingly and intelligently waived his right to counsel.
Yeah, he always ended up wanting a lawyer, right. You know, and he's on the heels of trial wanting another or a different lawyer to discharge this lawyer.
Right.
Okay. All right. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Justice Prosser.
When the defendant asks to represent himself, what are the circumstances under which the court may deny that request?
Well, if the court finds that the waiver is not knowingly and voluntarily made, if the court finds that the defendant doesn't really understand the nature or the seriousness of the charges, if the court finds that the defendant doesn't really understand the dangers and problems of proceeding pro se, or if the court should find that the defendant is not competent to proceed pro se.
Counsel, before you sit down, I have to apologize to you. I have found further in Klesig a statement citing a U.S. Supreme Court case, and I assume it accurately is represented as the denial of self-representation at trial can be a cause for structural error.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. I have two questions for you. Assuming the court would disagree with you that this colloquy was sufficient, would you like to brief that issue and ride on that one?
No.
Okay. And
if four members of the court sui sponte want to overrule Klesig, would you be interested in weighing in on that?
That I would be interested in weighing in on, right.
Mm-hmm. I don't have any more.
Let me just tell you broadly what drives our position in this.
Good idea.
In this case. And it's a very practical decision. We just think the easiest way to handle this case would be to send it back for a retrospective hearing because we are absolutely convinced that we would win on the retrospective hearing and that would end the case. We think the retrospective hearing would show that Imani did not knowingly and intelligently waive his right to counsel and had no idea of what waiving counsel would entail, and then that would be established at the retrospective hearing. So that's what drives our position here.
Go ahead, Dave.
Normally, when things are sent back for a hearing like this, the state has the burden.
Right.
And I think you're saying in this hearing, the defendant has the burden. Is that right?
Yes, because of the presumption of non-waiver. The presumption shifts the burden to the party who's saying that there was a waiver.
And does opposing counsel disagree with that?
I didn't understand him to disagree.
The Cressick case, which John Justice Wilcox wrote, I agreed with him, but concurred as to the remedy, citing a number of cases that look to the difficulty about a non-pro-tunc kind of hearing.
And I know that you dissented, you stated in Cressick that there would be real problems.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, what I hadn't done, and I didn't do in preparation for this hearing, and I apologize, but it wasn't only I, but there were any number of Supreme Court decisions declining to allow non-pro-tunc, which I cited, including the Dusky. They were not related to the issue here, but to the general concept that X number of years later, you can go back and reconstruct what somebody knew, didn't know, waived, didn't waive, et cetera. Quoted various people suggesting that there'd be difficulties. I haven't gone back to look and see if the cases are having difficulty with non-pro-tunc. Do you know that?
I have no personal knowledge.
I just don't know. I mean, you know, we can predict things and they may not ever happen.
But let me just say that I agree that it is difficult to hold a non-pro-tunc hearing. It's not impossible.
That's right.
It depends on the case. And in this case, both the district attorney and I are absolutely convinced that we can do it.
That's two out of three.
At least two out of three.
Thank you, Mr. Bellastrary.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Loeb, Basil M. Loeb, representing Mr. Amani.
Yes, good afternoon, Your Honors. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this afternoon. I'd like to start by discussing how Cressick is different than the situation that's before the court today. And it's already been touched on by a lot of you this afternoon. The situation in Cressick is a defendant who asks a trial court to proceed pro se at trial. He is granted that request. So he is granted the right to self-representation, proceeds to trial. He loses at trial. On appeal, he argues that he didn't validly waive his right to counsel and his conviction should be overturned. Now, what this court did in Cressick was rule that a trial court had to establish that a defendant was voluntarily, knowingly, and intelligently waiving his right to counsel before that court could allow the defendant to elect self-representation and to proceed pro se at trial. We have a different situation here today because Amani specifically asked the court to proceed pro se. He specifically asked to conduct his trial on his own, and he specifically asked to elect self-representation, and the trial court denied his request without going into the proper factors as outlined in the Cressick opinion. Now, my feeling is that the Supreme Court back in 1997 tailored the retrospective hearing remedy for Cressick based upon the facts in Cressick, meaning that a defendant asking to proceed pro se gets his wish, loses at trial, comes back on appeal and says that he did not waive his right to counsel. And if the court also knows, at that stage of the game, the retrospective hearing would be a determination as to whether the defendant knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waived his right to counsel. Non-waiver would apply, and it would be the state's burden of proof to show that the defendant's waiver of counsel was knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently made. Now, in this case, the state is suggesting that the case go back for a retrospective hearing, and it would be Amani's burden of proof to show that he waived his counsel knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently. So one of the huge differences that I see in the two cases is that the remedy that Klesig provides for involves the state having the burden of proof to prove that a defendant's waiver of counsel was knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently made, whereas the state's position in this case is for Amani, who obviously suffered a violation because the trial court did not conduct the proper questioning when he asked to proceed pro se. State saying, Amani, you got to go back and at a retrospective hearing, the burden of proof is on you to show that your waiver of counsel was knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently made. Issue number two is the fact that Klesig and Pickens, which I think are the two main cases that are at question here, both, framework in Klesig and Pickens assumes that the waiver of counsel occurred at the trial court level, and the defendant in both Klesig and in Pickens asked to proceed pro se, and that request was granted by the court. The case we're dealing with today is a defendant who requested to proceed pro se but was not permitted to do so. So in my opinion, we aren't really dealing with a defective waiver of counsel or an invalid waiver of counsel, which is what Pickens and Klesig argued, but in a situation like what Mr. Amani is arguing, there wasn't a waiver of counsel because Judge Davis would not allow it. So to me, those are crucial differences between Pickens and Klesig and the case that's before the court today. And I think the Klesig remand order for the retrospective hearing really assumes that the framework and the procedural posture of the case is a defendant asking to proceed pro se and a trial court granting that request, and then a defendant coming back having sour grapes after losing at trial, despite having the fact that what he asked for he got from the trial court. The defendant would come back on appeal and say, oh no, I didn't validly waive my right to counsel. So I think when the court established the remedy in the Klesig case, the court was under the assumption that the situation would be a defendant would ask the court to proceed pro se, that request would be granted, and then on appeal, a defendant would say, no, I didn't waive my right to counsel, the conviction should be overturned.
Go ahead, Justice Prosser.
I'm trying to follow your argument. You want a new trial.
Correct.
You don't want a hearing.
Correct.
Suppose we say, you get a hearing. How do you want that hearing structured? Who has the burden of proof? And if you have the burden of proof, the defendant, what do you have to prove?
Well, it depends what the issues would be at the retrospective hearing. Are we talking about whether Amani knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently waived his right to counsel, or whether Amani was competent to proceed pro se? There's two separate issues that have to be put into play here.
Why don't you tell us how you would write the opinion?
In my opinion, I think that the competency to proceed pro se is already established by the record that Judge Davis made when Amani asked to proceed pro se on his own. And as the court knows, the Pickens decision governs the issue of competency to proceed pro se. And I think this court can look at the record established by Judge Davis and make a determination that Amani read and wrote at a college level. Amani was fluent in English. Amani had an 11th grade education. Amani did not have any physical or psychological difficulties that would have prevented him from conducting his own defense or prevented him from conducting and presenting a defense to the jury. Amani understood the nature of standby counsel. That's listed in the transcript. Amani understood the importance of the fingerprint issue, which he complained about. Amani understood that his trial date was fast approaching and that, in his opinion, his lawyer at the time was procrastinating and not doing the job that Amani thought that that attorney had to do. So if I was authoring the opinion in this case, I would find that, based upon the record established by Judge Davis, Mr. Amani possessed the minimal competency that's required for him to be able to proceed pro se. The fact that it was 4 weeks before the trial date is irrelevant. The fact that Judge Davis did not want to have a disruption with the court's trial calendar is irrelevant. The fact that Imani may have been of average intelligence or ability was irrelevant. The issue is, does he have the minimal competency that's required for him to proceed pro se and to present a defense to the jury? And if you look at the record, not only did he explain to Judge Davis what that he was fluent in English and that he read and wrote English and that he understood what the issues were, but he knew the trial was fast approaching. He had been preparing for the case for 13 months, as he discussed. He told Judge Davis he was prepared to present a better defense than his current attorney was prepared to present for him. So I think it's clear that at the very least he possessed the competency that's required to proceed pro se. So with respect to that aspect of it, I don't think a retrospective hearing is necessary. I would ask this court to find that, based on the record established at the hearing in July of 2007, Imani possessed the minimal competency that was required for him to be able to proceed pro se. Now, I took that in inverse order because I think that the issue with whether Imani knowingly, intelligently, or voluntarily waived his right to counsel, I think it's too late in the game. I think it's too difficult to go back and have a retrospective hearing and have Judge Davis ask him the four questions that the state says he should ask. He's going to ask Imani if Imani understands the seriousness and the potential consequences of the case. Imani's been to trial, he's been convicted, and he's been sentenced. Obviously, 3 years later, he's going to be able to tell Judge Davis that he understands the seriousness of the charge and the potential consequences that he faces. Obviously, he understands that there can be difficulties in proceeding pro se. The problem is the whole process is tainted because as soon as Imani made the request to Judge Davis, Judge Davis did not inquire into those four factors that the Klesig opinion mandates Judge Davis to do. And in my opinion, it's too late. There's a reason why this court established the colloquy rule back in 1997. And for this court to allow Judge Davis a second chance at things now, I think would be completely inappropriate.
I didn't understand what the Court of Appeals meant when it said in its reconsideration motion, denial of that motion, it said something like, well, let's not reconsider, let's not look at this again at the trial court for a rehearing because we don't know whether he's going to do on the new trial. I didn't understand that.
I think the language was whether he was going to elect self-representation
at the new trial. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I think the Court of Appeals in writing that is saying that because we're ordering a new trial, things are starting from scratch, and Imani can proceed to this new trial with counsel, or he can proceed to the new trial and elect self-representation. And if he elects self-representation, then at that point in time, the trial court would have to make a record of that issue. So I think they're taking a bit of a, an attack on the trial court for not making an accurate record when Imani requested to proceed pro se in this case.
Mr. Loeb, how does your analysis about the advisability or practicability of sending it back to the trial court for the retrospective hearing run with the fact that the trial court didn't seem to permanently foreclose the possibility? The transcript indicates that having been the recipient of this motion on the spur of the minute with no notice, the trial court asked some questions, came to the conclusion that the reasons Imani gives, they seem to be episodic driven. He comes to court today on a motion, he doesn't win the motion, and now he is disgruntled. That's in and of itself not a sufficiently rational basis to justify such a decision. That is the decision to proceed pro se. But then the trial court went on in the transcript to say, if you renew your motion, if you bring it again, I will consider it again. Doesn't that seem to be at least an indication that the trial court anticipated the possibility that Mr. Imani would renew the motion and the trial court's receptiveness to considering it?
Well, I think it might have, and I think the trial court also mentioned some type of hybrid representation where the trial court would allow Imani to ask questions of some witnesses and have his attorney, provide an opening statement and ask questions from other witnesses. But My feeling is that the fact that the denial of Amani's request for self-representation is the be-all and the end-all here, and anything that occurred after that is irrelevant, and anything that occurred after that is tainted, because the fact that Judge Davis did not ask the correct questions when presented with the request for self-representation, no matter how flippant or immature Judge Davis thought it was, Judge Davis still should have gone through the proper analysis, and Judge Davis's failure to do so taints everything else that happened in this case, including further hearings, including the trial, including the sentencing hearing.
I'm sorry. I was asking it within the context of the remedy of a retrospective hearing. I'm not clear on your point about how the proceeding would be. What in your opinion, taints such a remedy?
Well, maybe taint is the wrong word. The rationale behind Class A, and I'll quote the language so that I have it correct, the colloquy requirement is the clearest and most efficient means of ensuring that the defendant has validly waived his or her right to the assistance of counsel and of preserving and documenting the valid waiver for purposes of appeal and post-conviction motions. So the very rationale behind the Klesig rule, which is trial court, when you're presented with this type of request from a defendant, establish a record and ask these questions, wasn't followed by Judge Davis. So allowing him to ask this 3 years later, to me, it seems futile. To me, it makes the Klesig rule insignificant, and it gives the trial court kind of another kick at the can here at Mr. Amani's expense.
But that seems less of an argument against a proper retrospective hearing, evidentiary hearing in this instance, than it does a foreclosure of retrospective hearings in general.
I would agree with that. I think that in this case, you know, it's not the waiver of counsel analysis was not invalid or deficient. It didn't happen. So why should Amani be prejudiced by having to go through everything again and allowing the court to try to, you know, have him go back 3 years in time prior to trial, prior to being convicted, prior to being sentenced, and to ask these questions? To me, obviously he's going to, you know, unless he's not intelligent, he's going to tell Judge Davis, of course I understand the difficulties and disadvantages of proceeding pro se. Of course I understand the seriousness of the charge. Of course I understand, and I'm making a deliberate choice to proceed pro se. To me, it seems like it would be, it's almost a useless thing to do. And again,
But all of those things, and I won't belabor the point, but it seems to me, unless I'm not hearing something or I'm hearing something incorrectly, mm-hmm. It seems like all of those would be equally valid arguments against a retrospective hearing in any instance where the judge didn't ask the prescribed question. And to be fair to the trial court, there was no notice here. It comes up in the spur of the minute. And so I don't think it would be unheard of in courtrooms around the country where any trial court, no matter how learned and diligent, doesn't follow the prescription of every case. But it seems to me you're not making a particularized argument in this instance. It's more of a general argument against retrospective hearings when some length of time and some prejudice or some adverse ruling has occurred.
Yes, I'm stating that the facts in this case are different than the facts in Klesig, so that the Klesig mandated remand order is not appropriate. And I'm saying that I think it's time for retrospective hearings to be eliminated or at least not chosen based on the particular facts of each case. I don't know if a per se rule is appropriate, but I would think that in a situation like this where the trial court did not conduct any aspect of the colloquy, that it should go back for a new trial no matter what.
Counsel, when someone's giving up their right to be represented by an attorney, that's a big deal. It's equally a big deal to let them represent themselves if that's really what they want to do. And that's what our Constitution provides for. That I get. But when you're talking about, did he make a deliberate choice to proceed without counsel? Was he aware of the difficulties and the disadvantages of self-representation? Was he aware of the seriousness of the charge? Was he aware of the penalties? Right? And those are what you go through. But you don't just ask those questions and have the person say yes, no, yes, no. You say, okay, well, describe for me. What are the rules of evidence? Tell me how you would get that piece of evidence in. How is it that you think you would exercise your right to talk to the jury in an opening or closing statement without making things that are objectionable, especially in a jury trial where you have two defendants, not just one defendant, two defendants, Bruton issues, other issues that could come. This is a fairly complex situation. It'd be one thing if Judge Davis went through and said, you know, I'm not going to ask these questions and I'm going to find that you've waived your right to a lawyer and let him proceed on his own. And there's no real right to standby counsel. You would agree with that, right? Even though he made that request, he doesn't have the right to pick and choose whether he has a lawyer as standby counsel. So it's kind of an all or nothing thing. Now, if Judge Davis would have gone through this and not asked the questions and not engaged in any inquiry at all and done nothing further and then said you waived your right, I agree with you. This isn't a class, this isn't, he didn't do enough, right? But here he did ask a number of things, and he did say, you know, I know a little bit about your education, 10th grade education, and you say you can do certain things at a college level, but this has got two defendants, you've had months you could have prepared, you've had a number of lawyers, you did, you know, he goes through a number of things, which, although he may not have used the exact phrase, I think that you are not aware of the difficulties and disadvantages of self-representation. Essentially, that's what he said. Now, it wouldn't matter. It really doesn't matter if he makes a deliberate choice to proceed, if he is aware of the seriousness of the charge, if he's aware of the penalties. If he doesn't meet that one criteria, Judge Davis cannot find that he's competent to proceed on his own. He cannot find that there's a waiver of counsel. So I'm having a tougher time, I guess, wrapping my head around this idea that the judge didn't ask the four questions, and therefore this is a classic violation. Because if he one thing, if he didn't ask the questions and he found he waived his right to counsel. But when he just makes a finding really on one of the four and says, it doesn't pass the smell test, you can't proceed here today, it's not going to work. He doesn't use the magic words. But to me, the kinds of things he said and did were essentially, you don't understand how tough this is going to be. And then he didn't let him waive his right to counsel. I'm just having a harder time with this idea that he had to engage in the four questions. He really just needed to find one of the four wasn't met.
Yeah,
really.
I agree somewhat, but I think his rationale for denying Amani's request had more to do with the fact that he thought that Amani was having an emotional outburst to losing the suppression motion, the fact that the trial date was getting so close, and the fact that he didn't want Amani, you know, for lack of a better word, tying up the court's calendar. And, you know, the case law states that those factors are not relevant. And if a defendant says, I want to go pro se, the trial court has to determine whether he validly waives his right to counsel, and the trial court has to determine whether the defendant possesses the minimal competency that's required to proceed pro se. And
I don't disagree with you on that, though, but what Judge Davis does say is, I'm not going to grant the request for him to represent himself at this time for the following reasons. While it's not a last minute on the clock, we're getting close to jury trial that requires substantial and extensive preparation. So, tough trial, substantial, extensive preparation. And because it's a two-defendant trial, it makes it particularly difficult to get that preparation on track. So again, you're going to have a tough time trying this case, two-defendant trial. We not only have the state, but we have two defendants. And everybody has to be prepared and ready to start the day at the same time, keep the case organized, keep it together. It is a different kind of trial when you've got a two-defendant trial than when you have just the state and one defendant. And that's what the judge is talking about. This is not your typical case where it wouldn't be that tough. And, boy, you know, I mean, if something goes wrong in this trial, it's two defendants' trials that get retried and redone. And he says that means that the potential threat of keeping on schedule is even a bigger issue than it would otherwise be. That makes sense to me. You know, if you don't know how to ask questions and get things into evidence and everything's a struggle,
especially in a two-defendant trial. Those are legitimate things. That's not just a judge saying, I'm not budging, this is my calendar, and we're keeping it this way. This is a judge saying, look, there are legitimate issues here as to whether you understand the advantages and disadvantages of being able to proceed here on your own. And do I think you can do it? And the judge is basically saying, no, I don't think you can. And he says, since you raised this issue a while ago, there's been more opportunity to prepare and be ready for trial. This is more of an 11th-hour request. I think that's a legitimate thing for court to take into consideration, especially with someone who's on their fourth lawyer. I also have in mind that Mr. Amani has had several lawyers. While he certainly is entitled to some degree to have the lawyer of his choice and to switch lawyers, that's not unlimited. It has to be balanced against proper preparation and conducting a trial. The reasons he gives seem to be episodic driven. This is what everyone's focusing on, this next part, but they miss all the previous stuff that the court goes through about how this is going to be not a run-of-the-mill, easygoing trial, which would not have any difficulty. The judge went through a number of things that are going to make this more difficult for him if he proceeds. Then he says, you know, this seems to be episodic driven. He comes today in court on a motion, doesn't win, now he's disgruntled. Now that is in and of itself is not a sufficiently rational basis to justify such a decision. And then he goes on. And then, you know, he says he's only got a 10th grade education. He reads at the college level. That's the only information I have on the subject of his education and background. He says he's been to court, but apparently those didn't involve trials. So again, the judge is saying, look, this isn't somebody who's tried cases before. He didn't represent himself. The judge is noting, gee, he hasn't proceeded on his own like a lawyer. So while he has observational experience, it hasn't been presented to me that he has any experience actually conducting proceedings like a criminal court trial. And so then he goes on to say, preserve the trial date, maintain the opportunities to be prepared and go forward, not to make a flippant, short-term, or immature decision that goes into effect. I'm going to deny it at this point. I'd be willing to hear about it later, but at this point I'm going to deny it. To me, that screams out, look, this person is not aware of the difficulties and disadvantages of self-representation in the context of this kind of trial. So that's why I'm having a hard time with this, because he could ask all day long, do you understand the charge? He could say yes. Do you understand the penalties? Yes. Are you deliberately choosing to proceed? I mean, that's a little closer call given what the judge found, but if the judge didn't find all four of those to be golden, Mr. Amani can't proceed on his own. So I'm having a harder time wrapping myself around this idea that you have to have the judge go through all four when the judge did what the judge did.
Well, then why did the court establish the classic rule, and why is there a specific jury instruction that outlines the questions that trial courts are supposed to ask defendants when they request to proceed pro se?
And I don't have a problem with that, and I tried to do that. And I think that's a good way to do it. Having said that, if three out of the four they meet, they still got to meet all four. Otherwise, they don't go on their own. You have to protect the right to be represented by counsel and have a competent, fair trial, too.
You know, but, you know, mere inconvenience to the court shouldn't have mattered. If Judge Davis was concerned about the trial dates, he could have postponed the trial. He allowed the co-defendant to proceed pro se. So, you know, there's a lot of other factors at stake here. The record just doesn't show specifically that Judge Davis made the specific finding that Amani, you know, was not able to make a deliberate choice to proceed pro se, and that Amani knew the difficulties and disadvantages of self-representation. That might be able to be inferred from the record that we have, but I think this case comes back to the fact that the record we have is not good enough. The fault lies with the trial court, and Amani is entitled to the relief that the Court of Appeals has ordered him to get.
Counsel, how many cases would we have to overrule? Because I know I just had here one of the cases. I pulled up the Ernst case that Justice Crooks wrote and others wrote in on it that affirms Klesic. And you know, Klesic is written in 97, and I'm sure there are a number of cases that cite to Klesic. So how many cases are we talking about, do you think, of overruling if we make it not mandatory?
Well, that depends. I mean, the court certainly can distinguish the facts in Amani with the Klesic decision,
right,
and then make the holding pertinent only to a set of facts that we're dealing with the Amani case, or the court can establish a per se rule when a trial court fails to conduct the proper colloquy when a defendant requests to proceed pro se. I don't think it's that prevalent around the state.
Probably not that prevalent because the jury instruction committee put together 24 pages in the criminal jury instructions as to all of the classic stuff and how you do it step by step, holding your hands, the number. In our special materials, that's the blue book for trial judges, there's, I think, 12 pages on the same thing. But the one in the criminal jury instructions that's 23 pages is much more helpful because that takes you through it bit by bit. And I just haven't had the time to read all of it, but there's a lot of cases cited, so I assume a number of those cases are following classic and citing them with approval.
There, and that's what I was referring to earlier. You know, the trial judges, it's been 13 years now since classic, so I think the trial judges should know that they have to do this, and, you know, they didn't in this case, and it's to Amani's detriment. But I don't think if the court implements a blanket per se rule barring, you know, the retrospective hearing, I don't think it's going to reach that many cases. There weren't that many cases cited in either counsel's briefs to this court. The state is bringing up analogy examples, the Bangert situation involving a guilty plea waiver, the new case that they cited today, which involves the right the waiver of the right to testify. So if they're looking for analogy cases, obviously there's not a lot of cases on waiver of right to counsel, which is what we're dealing with here.
Did you say that the co-defendant had counsel or didn't have counsel?
No, he was entitled to proceed pro se.
He went pro se.
He did. He did not go complete all the way to trial, though. He ended up pleading guilty.
How was the colloquy with him?
I don't know. I cannot recall.
If they had gone to trial, both of them, would the co-defendant have had, and the co-defendant was represented by an attorney, would that defendant have any say whatsoever in the decision on whether Imani represented himself?
No, I don't think there's any case law indicating that a co-defendant would have a stake or an interest in whether or not the other defendant was going to be proceeding pro se. I guess I would argue if a co-defendant had a problem with that, they could request the trial court for severance of the trial and to have their own separate
trial.
So
then there would be two trials?
Perhaps in a situation like that, yes.
They couldn't both be held at the same time.
No.
So the judge might say there'd be a scheduling problem.
I don't think so.
Thank you. Are there any other questions?
Thank you.
For your time today.
Pardon me?
Thank you for your time today.
You're welcome, sir. Mr. Ballester, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
You asked me when I made my primary presentation here whether I would like to weigh in on the question of whether Klesic should be overruled, and I gave you an answer. And I would like to point out to you that it was not an entirely flippant answer as to whether we would like to weigh in on the issue. And I would just like to point out to you what our argument would be or would likely be if there were such a question and if we were allowed to weigh in on it. And that is that under the federal system, the federal courts have expressly declined to adopt a Klesic-type rule. And if I could just cite you a recent case out of the Seventh Circuit, it's James Smith versus Grams, G-R-A-M-S, and the citation is 565 Fed 3rd, 1037. It was decided in May of last year. And it points out that I have a copy of the slip opinion here. It's page 19 of the slip opinion that the Supreme Court has not provided extensive direction on the procedures that the court must observe before finding a valid waiver of the right to counsel. And in light of that, the Seventh Circuit has refused to adopt a Klesic type requirement
So what do they adopt?
For the kind of colloquy that must be heard. And if you should decide to revisit the issue, I think we would place great reliance on the position of the Seventh
Circuit. What does the Seventh Circuit do then?
They just consider all of the factors in the record without requiring any specific question of the defendant and any specific response. I might point out that in this particular case, in the Smith case, they wound up holding that the defendant did not validly waive his right to counsel. So, but at any rate,
but you think the case is for you anyway?
I'm sorry.
The case is for you anyway.
The case would be for us on a revisitation of Klesic.
So why do you object to Klesic?
I'm sorry?
Why do you object to Klesic? I mean, you got a bright line rule here.
Well, some of the members of the court don't think we necessarily have a bright line
rule. Well, but you know, you give the colloquy, you don't. It's sort of like Bangert and Bentley. Something to be said for it. Something to be said.
There is something to be said for it. There's, from our position, there's something to be said against it, and that is, if you don't hold the hearing, regardless of what the record might show, you get a reversal. Mm-hmm.
Justice Wilcox, in the later case in Ernst, wrote, "I agree with the majority opinion." He was writing it concurring here. That this court should continue to require the waiver of counsel set forth in State versus Klesic. This is the important part. As the court recognized in Klesic, such a colloquy serves to conserve judicial resources on appeal and ensures that a valid waiver of counsel is taken in a clear and efficient manner.
There's a lot to be said for doing the colloquy. I'm not saying that, well, you did require it in Klesic. You've required it in a whole string of other cases, you know, starting with Bangert. I'm not saying that it's clear that Klesic should be overruled. I'm just saying that there would be a basis for arguing that it should be overruled, that it's not a universal rule.
Any circuits adopt Klesic?
I'm sorry?
Any of the circuit court appeals adopt a similar rule to Klesic?
Federal courts? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I haven't really delved into it.
Probably a split.
I haven't really considered it. Until you brought it up in this oral argument.
I
hadn't considered it.
Good.
Well, it should be.
No wonder you hadn't considered it, because it's not an issue in the case, but
right.
Nevertheless.
Right. It's just that I happen to know about this Seventh Circuit case, and I happen to it stands for the proposition that at least the Seventh Circuit isn't going to adopt the rule.
And also, it does seem to make, just to point out a line of questioning that was commenced by Justice Ziegler in regard to the court's conduct of the entire prescribed colloquy from Klesic, when in fact it is, I think the word has been bandied about during this hearing, obvious that, at least to the trial court, that at least one of them, one of the factors has not been met.
I think it was pretty obvious to the trial court. I don't think you can dispute that at all. The trial court thought it was not a voluntary waiver.
Is the Smith case a Klesic-type case, or is it an Amani-type case?
Well, it's neither, because the federal court doesn't have this procedure. So,
what are the facts?
Is it waiver of counsel?
It was just a waiver of counsel case. The issue in the case was simply whether or not the defendant had knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently waived his right to counsel. There was no procedural issue.
Did he proceed pro se or with a lawyer? That's the question, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get at.
I don't recall.
Well, it must have been pro se if you said the holding was that he had not knowingly.
He had not knowingly waived his right to counsel. Yeah, the court declined Smith's request to appoint him attorney to appoint him an attorney, so he did proceed pro se.
He asked to be represented by an attorney, and the court declined it?
Well, it was one of these equivocal situations.
Everything's said, more complicated.
He said, I want an attorney, but I don't want an attorney, and, you know.
All right. We'll read it.
That's why they found that he did not knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently ask to proceed pro se, because he was all over the board.
Thank you, Mr. Balistrieri, and thank you, Mr. Loeb, for arguing a right to counsel or right to pro se case. That concludes our hearing in 08 AP 1521 CR, State versus Amani. The court will meet in closed conference at 3:20, and will be sitting tomorrow for another three cases in oral argument. We are in recess.